What do the following have in common? The music you're hearing from Gounod's Faust, Darwin's Origin of Species, John Brown's Raid on Harper's Ferry, Edward Fitzgerald's The Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, John Stuart Mill's On Liberty, and Charles Dickens' A Tale of Two Cities. All took place or were published in the year 1859. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
Victorian poet Matthew Arnold had written in 1850 that he felt he was wandering between two worlds, one dead, the other powerless to be born, with nowhere yet to rest his head. By 1859, science was challenging religion in a major way in Victorian England. America was about to elect Abraham Lincoln and head rapidly into civil war. What does a look at some of the publications and events from the year 1859 tell us about this particular historical moment, this time of new beginnings? Joining us to explore 1859 is Joseph Wiesenfarth, professor emeritus of English at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and the author of many books, including Studies of Jane Austen, Ford Madox Ford, and the Gothic novel.
Welcome back to University of the Air, Joe.
It was the best of times and the worst of times, and I'm glad to be here anyway.
Well, hope for the best. When I was in eighth grade, I wrote a term paper called 1898. And it was exactly this approach, but in about eight pages. And that's the sort of thing eighth graders do. You get two or three lines for each important event, and then you're off to the next footnote. But it does seem that some years have this way of peaking and having a lot of particularly important and interesting things happen. So what's the deal with 1859?
I'm not sure why all these things happened in 1859, but it's interesting to think of it as coming between 1851 and 1867, which are 2 years that are generally considered to be the beginning and the end of the High Victorian period. And in 1851, we had the publication of a number of works of great significance. And in 1867, we had the Second Reform Bill, which was passed. And the Second Reform Bill was one that gave a nervous shudder to many people, because the first reform bill gave the vote to the middle class, and the second reform bill was to give the vote to the working class, and people were not sure that that class was educated enough to cast a vote.
My gosh, it's Tony Blair before Tony Blair.
It's all the same thing. I was mentioning to Emily before that there were actually seven reform bills between 1832 and 1969. And the last reform bill in 1969 lowered the voting age to 18, prior to which it had been 21. And then in 1918, as you probably know, women in England got the vote for the first time, but they were not allowed to vote until they were 30 years old. And the reason that that happened was because so many men were killed in the First War, and they wanted to have a representative government. They didn't want to have women governing all those men who were governing the women.
Of course.
How British.
Well, and yes. I've always thought of all those reform bills in England as being its substitution, really, its substitute for revolution. I mean, it never really had what France had, what America
right.
had in terms of the growth of democracy and the resistance of a monarchy. I mean, here you still have the Queen of England, but you have all these reforms taking place. What difference do you think it makes when we look at 1859 that you have Queen Victoria sitting on the throne and sort of firmly in power at this point?
Well, her reign was so long and her reign was so stable when one thinks about other monarchs, that it gave to England a sense of being a country that was not going to get itself into the kind of trouble that France got itself into. And she came to the throne in 1837. And then in 1851, we had this great exhibition of the works of the English that took place in the Crystal Palace. And that was the first World's Fair. So that could not possibly have taken place unless England was considered to be a place where other countries in Europe could come and display their wares. And Victoria And Alba, too, who was very interested in the Crystal Palace and this great exposition, were the people who seemed to be the focus of the attention of the public as well as the attention of Europe. Other countries seemed to be more interested in revolutions. After all, 1848 was a great year for revolution, but there was no revolution in England. And 3 years later, we have the opening of the Crystal Palace, which was the first prefabricated industrial building ever to be put up. It was the product of a man named Joseph Paxton, who had been a gardener, who had been involved in building hothouses. And what the Crystal Palace was in 1851 was a big hothouse.
and it's the kind of thing that only a country very secure would build, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it lasted quite into the 20th century. It was first in Hyde Park, and then it was moved away into its own location. But somehow, and I'm not quite sure how glass and steel does this, it burned down. Must have been everything that was in it that went up in flames.
Well, and certainly it must have seemed a triumph of science, a triumph of industrial power, invention, technology.
Mm-hmm.
One of the kind of pivotal publications, I suppose, of 1859 would be Darwin's Origin of Species and all the shudders that that must have sent through the world at that point. Here's a passage from Origin of Species. "The great power of selection is not hypothetical. It is certain that several of our eminent breeders have, even within a single lifetime, modified to a large extent their breeds of cattle and sheep. It goes on, I have called this principle natural selection, but the expression survival of the fittest is more accurate and equally convenient. Natural selection is a power incessantly ready for action and is as immeasurably superior to man's feeble efforts as the works of nature are to those of art." With Darwin suggesting that we are like the animals in many ways, that the power of natural selection among human beings is much like breeding cattle. What difference do you think that made to how people conceived themselves, wrote about themselves?
Well, you know, we are in an era here where people are very religious, where prior to Darwin, there was a geological revolution in the sense of discovering the layers of rock and so on that indicated that the Earth was not 6,000 years old, but millions of years old. And then you had those people in evangelical circles who were saying, well, God just put those there so that we have a sense of his ability to do anything that he pleases to do. But when this was followed up by a biological revolution, this became more serious because this absolutely called into question not only the way that people worked out numbers for the creation of the earth, but it called into question what God had said in terms of Genesis and the creation of Adam and Eve. So you have a real problem that goes on to the present day. You know, we still have a problem with people accepting the science of the origin of species. And it's interesting to note that Darwin made a 5-year trip in which he gathered the information that came to be part of the vast amount of evidence that he used in The Origin of Species. And it took him 20 years to write it, so it wasn't something that he just did off the top of his head. And it took time, but eventually, in his own time, people said, yes, what he's saying seems to be true. And this whole idea of natural selection and survival of the fittest seemed to be something that people who were religious in terms of the literacy of the Bible just simply could not deal with. And consequently, we have the kind of controversy that sprung up then and is still with us now. It's also interesting to note that Darwin himself, when he graduated from Oxford, went into the priesthood. He was an ordained minister.
I forgot that.
Isn't that
That's
a fascinating contrast?
But instead of going to a parish, he got on the Beagle and he took this long trip.
Spiritual journey of another kind.
Around the world, yes, collecting all of this information. So we do have that coming along with the industrialization of England. And these two things, I think, are prominent in between the years 1851 and 1867 and give a lot of thought to what really England is and what England wants to be.
What were the developments in social thinking in those times leading up to 1859?
Well, there was a very strong carryover from Jeremy Bentham's 18th century utilitarianism. After all, John Stuart Mill was a utilitarian. His father was a disciple of utilitarianism, and he passed that on to his son starting at the age of 3 when he learned Greek, started learning Greek.
That's very utilitarian.
Yes.
At least in Victorian England.
In Victorian England. It gave you those things to say that nobody would understand. But I think the principal social developments that came out of the Industrial Revolution were the number of people who became rich by becoming entrepreneurs, and even larger number of people who had to work for those rich people. And we're talking about here the labor of women and the labor of children in all sorts of jobs, 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, and this was thought to be appropriate in order to keep England at the top of the heap, to keep it as the nation which was the richest nation in the world, which could send out its people to all different parts of the world and colonize them, and enable England to make the claim that the sun never set on the British Empire.
And the Indians used to say that's because God didn't trust the British in the dark.
Well, I didn't know that, but I'm pleased to hear it. So I think industrialization and the growing riches of one class and the growing poverty of another class. And this was why when things approached 1867 and there was a possibility of a second reform bill, a reform bill that would take in the working class, that even people like John Stuart Mill, whose famous book on liberty, really advocated a greater democratic way of doing things, were worried about these things.
And his On Liberty came out in that year that we're talking about, 1859.
His On Liberty came out in 1859. Mill says in the introductory section to On Liberty, "This is the appropriate region of human liberty. It compromises first the inward domain of consciousness, demanding liberty of conscience in the most comprehensive sense, liberty of thought and feeling, absolute freedom of opinion and sentiment on all subjects, practical or speculative, scientific, moral, or theological. The liberty of expressing and publishing opinions may seem to fall under a different principle, since it belongs to that part of the conduct of an individual which concerns other people. But being almost of as much importance as the liberty of thought itself, and resting in great part on the same reasons, it is practically inseparable from it." And Mill goes on in the book constantly to talk about things of this kind that were radical in his day. I mean, when we think of John Stuart Mill, we have to think of John Stuart Mill as the founder of the Liberal Party, of a kind of liberal politics, because he believed in everybody's having something to do with the government, although he was a bit nervous, as I said before, about the working class getting the vote because they were not educated, so that what he wanted to do was promote education. He wanted to make people comfortable with their lives so that they would be comfortable with their government. But I read somewhere that that has nothing really to do with John Stuart Mill or the time that we're talking about, that every time there was some reform proposed, it was worried that the new people who would be enfranchised would mess up the whole system.
Of course.
But the way they messed it up was by acting like everybody who had already been in the system. So that really nothing terrible did happen. However, Thomas Carlyle in 1867, when the reform bill was imminent for passage, wrote a book called Shooting Niagara and After. and in Shooting Niagara and after, he says that passing this reform bill would be like putting England in a barrel and sending it over Niagara Falls. When it gets to the bottom, it'll be destroyed.
This is not, I guess, a matter of immigrants coming into England so much as rural people coming into the cities. Was this a time of still of great urbanization in England?
Absolutely, yes. It was the country fleeing to the city because in the country you had what was called the enclosure of pasture lands, and these were enclosed by rich landowners who would then use the enclosed pastures for their own stock and for their own growing purposes, which excluded the small farmer from going there and grazing his cattle and grazing his sheep and so on. So that these people who once were able to live in harmony with the large landowner from whom they rented property or whose large acres they were able to use for their own cattle and sustain themselves and their families, these people no longer had a way to live. So they came to the world of factories and were absolutely strange to the city.
Well, one author that we link with sort of, I guess, championing the working class and their rights would be Charles Dickens.
Yes.
Trying to make us aware of, through Oliver Twist, of someone needing more to eat or just the dignity of the working class. Can you say something about the year 1859 and what Dickens would have published by this point and how Tale of Two Cities, which came out in this year, somehow was part of this time that we're talking about?
Well, Tale of Two Cities is a tale of London and Paris, and if it's the best of times and the worst of times, it's the best of times and the worst of times in both those cities. And when you think of Tale of Two Cities, the problem that we have in Paris is the aftermath of the revolution and the resorting to the guillotine to solve problems. But we have to remember that Sidney Carton, who is the hero of that story, is a lawyer who was defending Charles Darnay, who is the one whose life is threatened in the novel because he has French ancestry. And Sidney Carton comes out of the legal system, which is seen to be as harsh in its own way as some of the things that are happening in a more bloody fashion. And what you have going on is a kind of comparison, but in that comparison, the Englishman is able to give himself in a way that none of the people who are part of the revolution in France are able to give themselves to things. So there is more than an implied comparison between the two cities, in the sense of they're both places where there are harsh things that happen. But the suggestion is that there is something a bit more civilized about England than there is about France at this particular time anyway. And it's interesting to think that hardly 40 years later, all the Englishmen will, with any kind of artistic talent, will be going over to Paris because they think that that's the place to be and that's the place to learn.
There's more suffering there, so better art.
Better art, more suffering, better art, right.
But do you think Tale of Two Cities is partly Dickens' sort of fear of what revolution would be like in England, sort of almost like a defense of the reform bill approach as opposed to revolution?
Well, I really don't know the answer to that question, but it could very well be that. I hadn't really thought of it in that way. I had really thought of it more as a comparison between two ways of life, one of which is subject to falling apart, the other which is so glued together, so to speak, by English law that it can become problematic in its own way.
Which is the same theme that he sounded in Bleak House at great length, is how entrenched the system was, which was a fault in its own way.
Right, right. When one thinks of something like Oliver Twist and Oliver standing there with his bowl saying, "More, sir, more," and having the reply, "Boy, I am a Turk," which is meant to be a way of saying, no, you get no more. You don't work hard enough. You don't deserve anything more than what you are getting.
A powerful symbol.
A powerful symbol, yeah. Powerful symbol, right.
More on the year 1859 when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
They almost always know the answer, and when they don't, they'll find it for you. Who are they? Audience Services at Wisconsin Public Radio. Call 1-800-747-7444 with your programming questions and comments.
Evening by evening among the brookside rushes, Laura bowed her head to hear, Lizzie veiled her blushes, crouching close together in the cooling weather, with clasping arms and cautioning lips, with tingling cheeks and fingertips. Lie close, Laura said, pricking up her golden head. We must not look at goblin men. We must not buy their fruits. Who knows upon what soil they fed their hungry, thirsty roots? That's from Christina Rossetti's poem, Goblin Market, from 1859. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Joseph Wiesenfarth. And we're exploring the year 1859 in literature, in history, in science, in many different areas. Joe, let's talk about women writers in general. We've been talking about Dickens and some of the other figures who were writing at this time. Besides Christina Rossetti's poem, Goblin Market, what other works by women writers were coming out in 1859?
It's interesting that you should read a bit from Goblin Market, because Ford Madox Ford said of Christina Rossetti that she was the finest poet in the 19th century. And the finest novelist was Jane Austen, who was long dead by the time that we talk about things. But when one thinks about the great line of women writers in the 19th century, certainly one has to think about George Eliot. And 1859 is the year in which George Eliot published Adam Bede. And Adam Bede, in its own way, is a kind of genesis, in the sense that he's giving us a new Adam, Adam who is a working man, but he's a working man in the older way of thinking about England. He's not a working man who is in a factory, but he's a working man who is a carpenter in the countryside and so on and so forth. But in that book, Adam Bede, which in its time became a bestseller and went through 5 editions in the first year that it was published.
Did they know that George Eliot was a woman at the point? I mean, did they know it
No.
was Marianne Evans? This
No.
was still done with the pen name.
They did not know. The readers did not know that George Eliot was a woman. And the reason for that was that Marianne Evans, born Mary Ann Evans, but by this time Marianne Evans, was living with George Henry Lewis in an documented, unsanctioned union. Lewis was at the time married to a woman who had 2 children by one of his friends, and he was unable to get a divorce from her because to get a divorce in England at this time required an act of parliament. And in order to have an act of parliament, you had to have a lot of money. So because Marianne Evans was a name known for the infamy of living with a man without being married to him, when she wrote under the name of George Eliot. George because it was Lewis's name, and Eliot, she said, because it was a good-sounding English name. And one of the reasons that Adam Bede was such a success is that it was very different from anything else that was going at the time, insofar as it dealt with ordinary people. And George Eliot has a chapter in Adam Bede, which is the 17th chapter, in which she writes about what she is trying to do in this novel. The chapter is called In Which the Story Pauses a Little. And the story pauses so that she can talk to the reader and tell the reader how she is writing this book and how the reader should read it.
Which sounds very Victorian to do.
Sounds very Victorian. Although it's interesting that John Fowles, when he wrote French Lieutenant's Woman, comes to a point where he's dealing with his character Charles Smithson, where he stops the novel and he says, I just don't know what I'm going to do with you. And then he talks about the possibilities of what he could do with his character. And then he goes on to tell some more of the story.
Art revealing art.
Right. And, you know, when you think about something like The French Lieutenant's Woman, you're thinking about a modern novelist who is trying to use all of the various Victorian clichés, so to speak, in a way that will make a different kind of modern novel. But one of the things that he's doing is stopping his story, just as George Eliot does to stop her story. She's just said something about a man who is a parson, whose name is the Reverend Mr. Irwin, and he has been speaking with Arthur Donnithorne, who is getting himself mixed up with a young woman whom he should have nothing to do with. But Arthur cannot quite bring himself to talk about what's happening, and he leaves without getting any kind of spiritual advice from Mr. Irwin. And chapter 17 begins this way. This rector of Broxton is little better than a pagan, I hear one of my readers exclaim. How much more edifying it would have been if you had made him give Arthur some truly spiritual advice. You might have put into his mouth the most beautiful things, quite as good as reading a sermon. And then the quotation from the reader ends, and George Eliot comes in and says, certainly I could, if I held it the highest vocation of the novelist to represent things as they never have been and never will be. Then, of course, I might refashion life and character entirely after my own liking. I might select the most unexceptionable type of clergyman and put my own admirable opinions into his mouth on all occasions. But it happens, on the contrary, that my strongest effort is to avoid any such arbitrary picture and to give a faithful account of men and things as they have mirrored themselves in my mind. The mirror is doubtless defective. The outlines will sometimes be disturbed, the reflection faint or confused. But I feel as much bound to tell you as precisely as I can what that reflection is. And George Eliot goes on in this chapter to compare her way of writing to the way that we have Dutch paintings, in which there are ordinary people doing ordinary things, and they are as much the subject of art as people who are all decked out in their finery and part of a life that we have little to do with. So what she's saying here basically is the kind of novel that I'm writing is a novel about the kind of people that you could meet every day. But what I'm doing is I'm exploring them the same way as one would explore a hero or a heroine from another rank of life, the kind of thing that you find in other novels.
Well, it's very democratic, too, if you say that ordinary people should and could be the subject of literature. It strikes me that Walt Whitman was doing that in America, sort of trying to be more democratic as to who could be in a poem.
Anthony Trollope, too, in his way.
Oh, absolutely.
Ordinary but extraordinarily entertaining people.
Yeah.
At the same time, though, you've got someone like Tennyson writing about King Arthur.
That's right.
Isn't that sort of contradictory then? If Idylls of the King also comes out in 1859, isn't it, in a sense, doing exactly the opposite of what George Eliot's doing?
Well, in a way, that's the case, because there is not only one thing happening in this period of time. And one of the things that is very characteristic of English artistic life is a nostalgia for the Middle Ages, when there are all those kinds of people whom George Eliot is not writing about. You know, there are knights and there are ladies and there are love affairs that are going on from atop a tower and the bottom of the tower, and there are jousts and all of these things. And there were any number of events that were staged by people who had fortunes and land, in which they would have people dressed in suits of armor carrying on jousts and knocking each other off horses, and not only doing that, but sometimes killing people. just so that they could be that kind of Englishman who had fixed the image of what an Englishman should be in terms of chivalry and love and passion and so on and so forth. So, yes, there is.
Tennyson is, of course, writing, unlike the others we've been talking about, is writing poetry rather than novels.
Yes. One of the interesting things about Tennyson, however, was that he was very interested in scientific developments. He followed them very, very carefully, and he had a sense of the way that science worked. But he was writing the way that he was writing. After all, he was the poet laureate, and he had to do some things he didn't want to do, I suppose.
Yes, yeah. Something that would be purely establishment, I'm sure.
So you're thinking that if he's writing about Lancelot and Guinevere and rhyming lines and so on, it's almost like an escape from the sort of Crystal Palace here and now steel
yeah,
and glass world.
It's an escape from the world that George Eliot wants to write about.
Well, there is another escape, too, not just in time but in place, and that's the kind of escape offered by the exotic of somebody like Edward Fitzgerald.
Well, when I think of John Stuart Mill, I almost immediately think of Edward Fitzgerald.
Wow, that's an interesting combination.
The reason I do that is because of the vast contrast between them. Here is John Stuart Mill from the time that he is a boy being trained up in a utilitarian way of life, learning how to think rationally, writing a book like On Liberty that is a totally rational approach to the problem of liberty and the way that people would have to lead their lives if they were to be free. He's really interested in that book in the individual and in ways of bringing about the liberty of the individual so the individual would have his own authority. And the whole book is a wonderful piece of logic.
Nobody quotes it too much, unlike the Fitzgerald, however.
That's right. Now,
that jug of wine and loaf of bread are irresistible.
Right. I read somewhere that that is the most quoted line from the 19th century. Here with a loaf of bread beneath the bough, a flask of wine, a book of verse, and thou beside me singing in the wilderness, and wilderness is paradise enough.
And somebody says, pass the thou. That's a famous cartoon sitting under the tree.
Right, pass the thou.
Can you say something about Edward Fitzgerald and the composition of this and what he's writing
the
about?
Translation, actually.
Yeah, it's a translation that took him quite a long time and that many people had difficulties with. But that is, people had difficulties with it, people who knew Persian. And, of course, there were a lot more Englishmen who knew Persian in those days than do now, simply because of the empire spreading out and people learning different languages because of the connection of England with these places. But what I think Fitzgerald is most famous for is his letters. You know, you look in a book of Victorian poetry for other things by Edward Fitzgerald, and all you find is the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam. And yet he has four volumes of letters to friends about everything. Apparently he was a great gossip.
Well, is it just a straight translation? Is it a good translation, or did he put his own
Victorian
spin?
My Persian is not such that I can... I can tell you that. I had a student once who was Persian who told me that various words that Fitzgerald translates would be better translated in a different way. For instance, the word cup, she told me, really doesn't appear in the original. It's really pot, and sometimes it's vessel. But seldom, if at all, do we ever get a cup of wine in it. But the interesting thing about it seems to me, is that it gives a totally anti-rational way of seeing things. For instance, this is a stanza 40. You know, my friends, how long since in my house for a new marriage I did make carouse, divorced old barren reason from my bed, and took the daughter of the vine to spouse. Which I follow
that's,
up with.
Right out of Mills, isn't it?
Yeah. And here is stanza 73. Ah, love, Could thou and I with fate conspire to grasp this sorry scheme of things entire? Would not we shatter it to bits and then remold it nearer to the heart's desire? Basically, what he's saying is, wow, the world is a mess, you know. But somebody like Mill is saying, the world is a mess, but if we apply our reason to it, we can change it. And what Fitzgerald is saying is, the world's a mess, it's going to stay a mess, we're all going to die, it's all written down in the book, there's nothing we can do about it, and when I die, turn down an empty glass.
There also seems, both in that and also in the Goblin Market that we opened the section with, a sense of repression and wanting to break out, whether it's with forbidden fruit or heart's desire. You know, you sense in the Victorians at this 1859 point, if you think of the way people were dressed,
yes,
you see very little skin.
Yes. Yes.
Yet the language, the literature is filled with all kinds of images of
yes.
forbidden fruit and so on.
Yes, I think that that's the case. Well, we started here with Christina Rossetti, and if we want some flesh, all we need to do is think about Dante Gabriel Rossetti, right, and the Pre-Raphaelite movement, which began in the 1850s, too.
Well, and even in Adam Bede, the subject has to do with an illegitimate child.
Child, right. And right.
There is
right.
always this sort of undercurrent, it seems, you know,
right.
even if everyone is being earnest and Victorian and
right. Well, of course, it makes sin much more interesting if you have strictures to revolt against.
Well, obviously. Yes, right. And this also ties in with the Idols of the King. That is, the Pre-Raphaelite movement ties in with the Idols of the King because it wants to go back to the painters before Raphael. The Pre-Raphaelites liked Raphael, but they didn't like what came after him because too much of it imitated what he, in his genius, made possible, so that they went back to painters who were before Raphael and gave us much more a sense of life at that time when what we're talking about are the late Middle Ages, okay? So we're back again in the Middle Ages with Pre-Raphaelite painting. And we've got lots of flesh, I think, in Pre-Raphaelite painting and lots of beautiful women. And of course, the way the Pre-Raphaelites carried on their own personal lives was hardly Victorian.
Oh, the Rossettis, you mean?
Yes. Right. And Rossetti not only had this bizarre situation of finally having married Elizabeth Siddal and by the time she was dying and then burying his poems with
and
her. Then
changing his mind.
And then changing his mind yeah. and digging her up and taking the poems out so that he could make a little cash. It's very strange. At the same time that anybody who visited Dante Gabriel Rossetti's house had to be very careful because he had a menagerie of animals, all kinds of animals.
You know, a wombat included.
And monkeys and all sorts of things, you know.
That brings us back to Darwin, I guess.
There, it brings us back, yes.
More on 1859 when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
The businesses, professionals, and organizations that support Wisconsin Public Radio's programming play an important part in our financial health. For more information about corporate sponsorships, visit wpr.org/underwriting.
Some of the inner torment experienced by Hamlet, as depicted in the year 1859 by Franz Liszt in what he turned into an orchestral poem by the name of Hamlet. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Joe Wiesenfarth. We're talking about that wonder year of 1859 in England and also in America. And a figure whose name keeps coming back is Charles Darwin, whose Origin of Species came out in 1859. We hear a lot, Joe, about people who came to all kinds of religious crisis because of Darwin's natural selection theories. We haven't heard so much, though, about the effect that it had on Darwin himself as an educated, cultured man in Victorian England. What was the repercussion for him?
Well, it seems that Darwin, in the process of doing all of the work that he did do, all of these years of looking at things and cataloging things and making himself into the preeminent scientist of the age, suffered a great deal in terms of anything like enjoying himself. I don't think he would have gone to any of the pre-Raphaelite shows. I don't think that he would have gone to see Hamlet. In fact, I know he would not have gone to see Hamlet. He wrote to a friend, "I have tried lately to read Shakespeare and found it so intolerably dull that it nauseated me. I have also almost lost my taste for pictures or music. I am glad that you were at the Messiah, but I dare say I should find my soul too dried up to appreciate it. And then I should feel very flat, for it is a horrid bore to feel, as I constantly do, that I am a withered leaf for every subject except science. The loss of these tastes is a loss of happiness."
Well, that would resonate with what a number of artists would have said. I mean, we've mentioned Matthew Arnold and being between two worlds, one dead, the other powerless to be born. He has put this biblical framework behind him, but he doesn't have anything to replace it with.
Right. And it's interesting to contrast Darwin in this context with Mill, because we know that Mill, as a consequence of the constant study and rational and scientific work in which he was put to, really came to a breakdown and came out of it reading Wordsworth and Coleridge.
I was going to mention Wordsworth, who has an appreciation for the danger that science can do if taken too far. You know, the figure of breaking the butterfly on the wheel and tearing apart that which is beautiful and losing it.
I think that what Mill found in Wordsworth was a license to allow himself to feel, to allow himself to experience things in a way that was different from reasoning about them, to see them, to feel them, to enjoy them.
And I'm thinking about Dickens, too, who has characters who start to feel like machines and act like machines and have to learn to be human again.
Like Wemmick.
That's right, in Great Expectations. At the same time that you have some of these pessimistic-sounding passages, sort of the worst of times sound, you also have these optimistic books about, sort of self-help books about how you can become anything, whether it's the Horatio Alger-type stories or the Samuel Smiles one. Can you say something about that, about Samuel Smiles?
Well, Samuel Smiles wrote this book called Self-Help, and it was published also in 1859. He had previously written a book on George Stephenson, who was the inventor of the railway engine. So I think that if I remember the title of this book, it was George Stephenson, Railway Engineer. And the first railway track was opened in the year 1830. And therefore, this was a good time to write a biography about the man who made that sort of thing possible. It was only 30 miles of track between two cities, but it was very, very important. And, of course, it made for the possibility of England being able to move the goods that were produced in the Midlands down to London and to the ports and so on. And so the railway was very important. But the book that he wrote after that was really a bestseller. that is self-help. And self-help is simply a book in which Samuel Smiles says that if you've got the initiative and you put yourself to it, you can be anything that you want to be. And one of the examples that sticks in my mind, and I read this book 20, 25 years ago, is that of an Englishman who had an idea that it would be wonderful if in England nails that were used in carpentry did not have to be imported from Scandinavia. So this man went to Sweden and took a job in a Swedish factory and memorized the mechanisms by which nails were made, came back to England, had this kind of machine made, made his own nails, and became a millionaire. In other words, he stole an invention and made himself into this self-made man. And Samuel Smiles has him as one of the heroes of self-help. He has helped himself very
literally. Helped himself to those Swedish patents.
The late George Mossy, when he taught 19th century intellectual history, used to lecture about Samuel Smiles and was certainly much more knowledgeable about him than I am, but it was what brought me to read this book. And he said that this book was really an immensely important book for the progress of manufacture and the progress of industry as well as small business in England.
Well, it's an interesting sort of development of that idea. I mean, if you compare the Horatio Alger formula, which is if you work hard and you're lucky, mm-hmm. you can succeed, to this, which is if you work hard, you're ingenious and maybe not 100% principled,
yes.
you can succeed. And so you have these interesting comparisons of formulas for success in England in 1859.
Yeah, right. This is the right principle as far as Samuel Smiles goes, right? So that worked out very well.
And a totally different sort of stand of principles, I guess, across the Atlantic would be John Brown,
uh-huh.
who says in his last statement to the court in 1859, after the Harper's Ferry raid that occurred in that year, he says, "I have, may it please the court, a few words to say. In the first place, I deny everything but what I have all along admitted of a design on my part to free slaves. I intended certainly to have made a clean thing of that matter, as I did last winter, when I went into Missouri and there took slaves without the snapping of a gun on either side, moving them through the country, and finally leaving them in Canada. I designed to have done the same thing again on a larger scale. That was all I intended. I never did intend murder or treason or the destruction of property or to exercise or incite slaves to rebellion or to make insurrection." But he goes on to say, "Had I so interfered in behalf of the rich, the powerful, the intelligent, the so-called great, or in behalf of any other friends, either father, mother, brother, sister, wife, or children, or any of that class, and suffered and sacrificed what I have in this interference, it would have been all right." That's sort of the other side then to the Samuel Smiles. He's saying, had I but been defending the rich,
yes.
I wouldn't be here in court about to lose my head.
Yes.
Well, it all has to do with whether you're working the system or not, doesn't it?
Well, I suppose that that's the case. It's even interesting if we go back to Mill. In Mill's thinking that everybody should in some way be part of a representative government. But really, if you are not educated and if you are not settled, if you are not composed internally in some way, you should not have the right to vote. And that's because the uneducated should not be the ones who are making the laws for the educated. But I don't recollect that Mill was worried about what Arnold called the barbarians, you know, the aristocracy. When Arnold wrote Culture and Anarchy, he talked about the upper classes, the aristocracy, as the barbarians.
Well, the upper class as the barbarians.
And the middle class as the Philistines, and the lower class as the populace. And that from neither one of these three classes will we find a way out of the impasse, the intellectual impasse, the social impasse in which we find ourselves. What we need to find is the person whom he calls the alien, the person who stands outside of these classes and is able to think for himself. And I think that he thinks the thinker might be
him.
You are, but whenever anybody that I've met has read Culture and Anarchy, they've been really inspired by it. I think it's a great book, but it's not of 1859.
I'm guessing that the writers we've been talking about in England, like George Eliot, who corresponded with Harriet Beecher Stowe, or some of the other figures, even if they're not writing directly about American slavery, they're aware of the coming of civil war that's going to break out within a few years. They're aware of the irony of American land of the free and the brave while having slaves. That must be part of the English thinking, too, is what's going on in America.
Well, yes, and of course the liberation of slavery took place much earlier in England. You know, we just had a celebration of the 200th anniversary of the ending of the slave trade in England in 1807. And it didn't mean that slavery ended in England, but it meant that the slave trade ended in England and had to be put an end to. This, of course, became a problem for English industry, especially if they were importing things from the States, especially if they were importing cotton from the States, so that some part of the English ruling classes were very much supportive of the South in the war rather than the North because their economic interests were tied to the South. So, yes, slavery in America was very much in the mind of the English in this period.
1859 was a year on the cusp of major happenings both in England and in America, and we suspect also in other parts of Europe as well. For example, it was the year that Verdi wrote Balo in Maschera, which had a very strong political theme, so strong that in fact he had to reset the opera in Boston. And that's why you get a character, the governor of Boston, instead of the king of Italy, let alone the king of Sweden in there. But it was a fascinating year in any event. We'll hear some Verdi on the way out. And thanks for joining us again this hour, Joe Wiesenfarth.
Well, you're most welcome. And maybe I can end with a little bit of that first paragraph of Tale of Two Cities in which Dickens said the period was so far like the present period.
In many ways. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, hoping you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air. Join us next Sunday afternoon at 4 for University of the Air as Jeremy Suri again is our guest, and we look at a person who won the Nobel Peace Prize but also is wanted in some places for questioning as a war criminal. Henry Kissinger next Sunday afternoon here on Wisconsin Public Radio.